what's going on? There's a war zone here today out in the heartland, but the union's here to stay. Those multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true, but they declare a war.
This is a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special reflecting on Labor Day, produced in the studios of WBAI in New York City. I'm Ken Nash.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg. The 21st century has ushered in a new class war against the workers of the world, who are competing against each other, thus lowering working and living standards. Each year, workers in developed countries get poorer, whatever the party labels of their elected leadership, while workers in the poorer countries remain poor. Economies may develop, but for the workers, things fall apart. Trade, migration, health, welfare, pensions, minimum wage, all are part of the race to the bottom in our standard of living under a bipartisan onslaught which shows no sign of abating. What is to be done? Can workers in one country fight their underdevelopment, or must workers of the world unite?
Later on, we visit South Africa and India and explore poverty and the labor force in the United States. But first, Jeff Foe sets the pace. Jeff is a co-founder of the Economic Policy Institute, and his new book is The Global Class War, How America's Bipartisan Elite Lost Our Future and What It Will Take to Win It Back. Welcome to our Labor Day coverage.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Jeff, you seem to be saying that free trade and globalization encourage businesses to become nationless enterprises that are totally detached from the economic well-being of the country in which they are operating in.
Right. I think there has been a change in the nature of U.S. imperialism, especially since the end of the Cold War. We all expected in the early 1990s, when the Soviet Union collapsed, that finally there'd be a peace dividend, money for health care and education and things of that sort, and it just didn't happen because after the end of the Cold War, the financial institutions of this country, the banks, the investment houses, Wall Street, etc., realized that they now could operate freely without any opposition from the Soviet Union or really the left worldwide, with the globe as their market and the globe as their economy. And the book talks about the politics of this globalization. Every market has a politics. It's a conflict among economic classes over who gets the benefits and who pays the costs. In a national market, where things is contained in national boundaries, there's a self-interest and a mutual dependence between capital and labor. We learned that in the 1930s, and from the 1930s to roughly the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, there was a social contract. Bosses, even though they didn't like it, went along with unions, unemployment compensation, minimum wages, because they understood finally that in order for them to prosper in a modern economy, they needed customers with money in their pockets to buy their goods. But with globalization, companies can get workers and customers anywhere. And today, the Ford Motor Company, and this is what they say publicly, says, we're not an American company. When we're in America, we're an American company. When we're in Brazil, we're a Brazilian company. When we're in China, we're a Chinese company. So the whole playing field has dramatically changed. The elites of the major nations, and the minor ones as well, now have more in common with each other than they do with working people who share their nationality. And you can see how that works in something like the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, where if you ask the question, well, who benefited? Canada, Mexico, the United States? You can't get a sensible answer, because the rich and powerful in all three countries benefited, and working people in Mexico, Canada, and the United States paid the cost. So we're in a new world now, and our language that we use to describe the economic impacts of globalization doesn't quite cut it. For example, we talk about the threat from China, and so we have this image in our heads when we open the newspaper that Chinese workers threatening American workers. But if you look at what that Chinese threat really is, it's a business partnership between the Chinese communists who provide the cheap labor and the American capitalists who provide the technology, and the investment money. More than two-thirds of all Chinese imports into the United States are financed by American and other transnational corporations. You know, we have these categories of China versus the U.S., Mexico versus the U.S., and they don't really describe what's going on in this new world of globalization, where the politics are cross-borders. And I call the developing global ruling class the Party of Davos, which I take from the Swiss resort, where every winter about 2,000 of the world's financiers and CEOs of multinational corporations and politicians meet to talk about what's going on. It's sort of their convention.
When you say the working class abroad and here are both suffering from this globalization, can you be more concrete about that?
First, I have to say that the problem is not trade. We have been trading with other countries, and other countries have been trading with each other for hundreds and hundreds of years. I get up in the morning and I drink coffee that's not made in the United States. The problem is that globalization is not just about trade. Globalization is about creating one market and one political economy in the world that's dominated by capital. So, again, it's not surprising that these so-called trade agreements end up being bad for working people on both sides of the border. One way to look at this is that since NAFTA was begun in 1994, and it's now 12 years later, productivity, that is, the wealth that's created by the workers, has increased in all three countries. It increased in the United States, it increased in Canada, it increased in Mexico. Real wages in all three countries have been stagnant. And in Mexico, they actually dropped for about 5 years. So the workers are getting less and less of a share of what they're producing in all three countries. And if you look at those same kinds of statistics for the rest of the world, you see the same kind of pattern. So that globalization has created a shift of the benefits, the income and wealth, from working people to people who invest across borders. Now, in the newspapers last week or so, we've been reading about the plight of the employees of Northwest Airlines. Massive cuts in salaries, laid off workers. The company advises laid off workers to look through garbage cans for things to wear and sell once they're out of a job. I mean, this is back to the 19th century ideas of economics. Dog-eat-dog capitalism. The advocates of globalization try to paint this picture of the future. Oh, globalization is the wave of the future. But in fact, it's reactionary. It's a return to the kinds of labor conditions, the kind of social conditions that existed in the worst part of capitalism's development in the late 19th century. It's a fundamentally reactionary idea. And we see it, the pattern that's going on in the United States is quite clear. When NAFTA was being debated, we were promised by Republicans and Democrats, by Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, that, oh, this might affect some of the unskilled people at the bottom of the ladder. But the rest of us would go up the skill ladder and get better and better jobs. And then we started to lose jobs from the blue-collar industries, where you have skilled people making things. And then we were told, well, yes, maybe the skilled blue-collar workers would lose their jobs, but they'll be able to get better ones, or at least their children will get better ones. Their children will become accountants and computer engineers. And now we're seeing accounting skills, computer engineering skills. We're seeing the outsourcing of radiology. And what would be better for your kid than for that kid to become a doctor? And we're seeing the outsourcing of that skill. So it's not just happening to people without skills. It's not just happening to people in manufacturing. It's gradually going throughout the economy. And that's the whole purpose of this. The purpose is to tear up the social contract that said, okay, you got a job with a company like Northwest Airlines, and you showed up for work every day, you did what you were told, you played by the rules, and then suddenly your pension's gone, your job is gone, or they cut you, 20% in your wages. So that really reflects a betrayal of the story that was sold to American workers. It worked for a while, but now with the opportunity to go global, the companies are just shredding that global contract, that social contract.
So if capital, in your theory, is not per se reliant on the contemporary nation state, how does this impact on patterns of immigration for the international working class.
The United States economy looks pretty good these days because of all the borrowing that's going on. To make it short, we ended up World War II with the world's currency, the U.S. dollar. And so we have this false sense of prosperity. They call it the hollowing out of American industry, and that is continuing to go on. So that here you have NAFTA, for example, which was supposed to create a booming middle class in Mexico. That was the promise. And ever since NAFTA, illegal immigration from Mexico. Now, these are people who are desperate for jobs, risking their lives crossing the border. 400 or so were killed last year, and probably more will die this year. And these are people evaluating NAFTA with their feet. Americans here, you open up the New York Times or the Washington Post or some of these newspapers, and they say, well, you know, sure, maybe some Americans lost their job, but it's great for Mexico. Well, if it's so great for Mexican workers, why are they risking their lives trying to leave Mexico? So it hasn't worked here, and it hasn't worked there. Now, one of the aspects of this that I think is interesting, you asked about imperialism. This party of Davos, the network of financiers and multinational businesses, it's not a world government. So they don't have an army, and that's why they need the United States military. The United States had 725 military bases around the world before 9/11. A decade after the Soviet Union collapsed, you ask yourself, what are we doing with all these bases around the world? Well, what we're doing is shoring up the party of Davos, the business partners of American corporations in all of these various places in Central Asia and Latin America. President of the United States, George Bush, announced he's starting the free trade negotiations with Colombia. Colombia has a record of murdering trade union activists that is the worst in the world. It's a place where a very small number of families own most of the country. It's been in civil war for 20 years. Why in the world would we want to have a free trade agreement with Colombia? One of the reasons is the ruling elites there like to kill trade union activists. So there's not likely to be much of a trade union movement in Colombia. So what we had sort of thought of as imperialism in strictly a military and political sense has now become very, very much economic. And Americans need to understand that Bush and Rumsfeld and the rest of them are not doing this for America. We know that oil had played a big part in the Iraq war. We know that was involved. And many Americans say, well, you know, I'm riding in this big car, I like my air conditioning, and so it's too bad, but, you know, maybe we have to stay in Iraq and we have to get that oil in order to make my life comfortable. Well, the fact is that we didn't go into Iraq so that Jeff Foe could ride around in an SUV. We went into Iraq in order that Texaco and Exxon and the rest of these companies could get a share of that oil. And they sell it on a world market. They don't pump it in Iraq and then bring it back to the United States. They sell it in the world market. And if you or I have $3.10 a gallon to buy the gasoline, they'll sell it to us. And if somebody in Brazil or someplace else has got $3.25, they'll sell it to them. Americans have this notion that, oh, well, if it's Texaco, it must be for us. Well, it's not.
Well, Jeff Foe, author of the book Global Class War, we'd like to thank you very much for expanding on that thesis.
Now with us, cultural worker Cy Khan.
We have been through a 50-year counterattack against the labor movement that has been bitter, entrenched, well-funded, vitriolic, often has crossed legal boundaries. What are historically the barriers to corporate, can we say hegemony on this show, to corporations owning everything and running everything and controlling everything? That's what we're talking about. What are the barriers to corporate expansion and overexpansion? And there really are only three categories, right? One is government itself, through its regulatory powers, through its legislative powers, through its powers of taxation. And the corporations have created this privatization agenda in large part to get rid of government. They don't want regulations. That's one of the counterweights to corporate power. A second one are popular movements, whether it's the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay and lesbian movement. These have served often as very, very effective counterweights to corporations. We've seen amazing campaigns, the Nestle's campaign, the Walmart campaigns. I don't want to even go through the Gallo boycott for the United Farm Workers under Cesar Chavez. We could go on and on. Then campaigns that have changed laws, changed relationships of power, and have pushed corporations back from where they wanted to be. And then there's the labor movement, which has often been a major force in getting government to change its policies, and is often a major ally of and support to other popular movements. But the labor movement occupies a particular role in the corporate hit list because corporations face their workers every day. The power of workers is much more immediate. That's rarely exercised. But a very strong union, as we see in some instances in this country, and you see often in other countries, really gets in the way of a corporation doing what they want to do. Evening hangs like smoke on this mill town that I love. My thoughts, they roll and tumble through the years. And my heart drifts through the haze back to Youngstown's better days. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. We're still here. We're still here. The mills have gone away, but we're still here with our neighbors and our kin, right here where we've always been. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. Looking down the street to the days when I was young, I can see my friends and neighbors strong and clear. They came from near and far away, built their lives from day to day. Through the good times and the hard times, we're still here. We're still here. We're still here. The mills have gone away, but we're still here with our neighbors and our kin, right here where we've always been. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. Dreaming down the days till time circles home, when our children face the future's hopes and fears. Nothing went the way it should, but we did the best we could. When the whistle blows for courage, we're still here. We're still here. We're still here. The mills have gone away, but we're still here with our neighbors and our kin, right here where we've always been. The mills have gone away, but we're still here.
Now to speak with us about work, workers, and poverty in the U.S., Avis Jones DeWeaver, Director of Poverty, Education, and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and Jose Salar, Director of the Labor Education Center, the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. How do the two of you assess the state of working America, the real look of the impoverishment of the working class? And maybe we can just start with Avis, and Jose, please feel free to chime in.
Sure. Well, the state of working America is one of just misery, I would argue, right about now. There is a great deal of discussion about the heralding of welfare reform as a huge success by using the barometer of how many people have been dropped from the welfare rolls. And it's also discouraging to see, in terms of the data as it relates to poverty, there has been a great deal of attention drawn to the fact that poverty levels are lower today than they were 10 years ago. And in doing that, once again, it also makes it appear as if the program itself was this huge success. What we fail to acknowledge when we look at BITS data in isolation is the fact that the great reduction in poverty that we saw in those 10 years actually happened in the first few years, in the late 1990s, when we saw a huge boom in terms of our economy. What's happened since 2000 has been tremendously disappointing. We've seen poverty go up each and every year. As of 2004, nearly 6 million more people were poor than was the number back in 2000. We've seen real wages stuck at the bottom. We've seen the minimum wage stuck at $5.15 an hour for nearly a decade now. So in terms of how individuals are doing, in reality, people are doing much, much worse off.
The income gap has widened dramatically in the last decade or so. Like Avis said, that real wages are stuck. There haven't been really much increases. And we feel it here. For example, I'll give you in New Bedford and in southeastern Mass, you have to question, why has the level of violence risen? It's because poverty has risen, because the education is not fulfilling it. There's no job for young people. There's no programs for young people. I mean, that's what the welfare reform has done. It's knocked out the ability to service young people, to have them have all kinds of programs and to have better jobs. And the kind of jobs that the city's according are jobs that are minimum wage jobs, the Walmarts, Home Depots, the Lowe's, all those places that don't pay that much money. And those are the people who are making a killing on this whole issue. So these people who are working in these places are not making any kind of living wage. That's the tragedy of this stuff. I don't know what they're using to say that poverty has diminished. And also, when you look at who basically guarantees that there's going to be people making better wages, is the labor movement. And when you look at the state of the labor movement, that gives you an idea why people are stuck where they are.
Avis, as if it wasn't bad enough or isn't bad enough, the unemployment rate last month took an upbeat, I mean a downbeat, it increased. And significantly, that entire increase was among black workers. During the late 90s, the differential in unemployment between black workers and the rest of the population narrowed a bit, but it's coming back. What's your thoughts?
It's very discouraging to see the huge racial dynamic to what's going on in terms of poverty and in terms of unemployment in this nation. And it's particularly disturbing in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, when we had this sort of epiphany in this country for a brief moment. We began at least to talk about the dynamics between race, class, gender in society, and then not really do anything afterwards. What we're seeing here is a reality in terms of going on with business as usual. There was a study that took place in Princeton that looked at the labor market chances of low-income males in New York City. And basically what they did was they took different men of different racial categories and gave them pretty much the same resume and sent them off to try to search for a job. And what they found, interestingly enough, was that a white man with a felony had a greater chance of getting a call back and a job offer after an interview than an African-American man with no criminal record. And I think that gives us some explanation as to what, in one respect, is going on in terms of these unemployment rates, particularly as it relates to African-American. It has to do with continuing discrimination in the labor market in terms of hiring. And in addition to that, it has to do with the way we do public education in this nation, which very much divvies access to quality education along the lines of race and class dynamics in terms of what schools have quality programming, are well-funded and well-run, and what schools do not. Until we expand opportunity in this nation in a more fair manner, I really don't see how we will overcome those huge deficiencies that we continue to have replicated year after year after year. If anything, if we continue to bury our head in the sand, I only see the situation getting worse.
Jose, in terms of, let's bring another element, we haven't really even brought in gender yet, but let's also bring the issue of immigrant populations, looking at the Latino population. How do they fit into what ingredient is there that distinguishes the circumstances of their lives?
Well, it depends who you're talking about when you're talking about the Latino population. I mean, the poverty is greater than ever before. But then again, you know, it depends. Since when we have to look at Latinos, we have to look at them not just as one group of people, but you have to look where they're from, how are they here, and look and see. That will tell you what how they're doing. For example, the immigrants, whether they're documented or undocumented, they're at the lower end of the scale. They're in the lowest paying jobs. In this area, that means the fish houses, where one of the things that they do to keep them from being able to organize and get better paid, better working conditions, is that they're coming in through temp agencies. the Bush administration and the NLRB appointees of Bush have made it very hard to organize people who are working for temp agencies. If you look at the general population coming in from other countries, which problem here is I think you got to look at the Latino population, where they come from. Are they from Central America? Are they from Mexico? Are they from Puerto Rico? Are they Cuban exiles or whatever you want to call them? Or what are they? Right? Because it varies. But in general, the Mexicans, who are the largest of all the Latinos in the United States, they've increased in poverty. And the Puerto Ricans have more or less remained the same in poverty. Immigration is a huge thing. And the level of discrimination has increased because of people not being able to distinguish who people are and because of the stigma that they're putting on immigrants in general. And in some cases, what was it, Hazleton, Pennsylvania, where they've passed laws which would make it illegal even to give a job to a person who has working papers. But that's the kind of mood that you're having here. You had in New Hampshire a sheriff that was trying to arrest especially undocumented immigrants, by using things like jaywalking or something and then calling immigration to see if they would deport them. And this is the kind of mood that you're facing. When you talk about Katrina and the immigrants that were brought in there, they were brought in by some of the Halliburton in them and are living in sort of like trailers with soldered-on beds. Not only are they being treated worse, they're also being pitted against people from that area who are now not being able to do those jobs because they've got somebody who will do it for less. It's almost like a form of slavery because these people have, it makes it real hard for them to fight for their rights.
And gender. Both of you.
You add gender to color and the exploitation quadruples.
Right? Yeah, it's just another layer to the problem. And I just want to echo, because I spent some time in New Orleans this summer and I spoke with an immigrant rights attorney down there, and it was just horrifying to hear about the deplorable conditions that individuals find themselves stuck in, living. Can you imagine the heat and humidity in New Orleans? But the heat and humidity down there is amazing. Can you imagine having to live in the back, basically, of an 18-wheeler truck, you know,
right,
those containers, as someplace to live, stuck in there with several other families? And the wages are so low when you talk about the gender dynamics, that traditionally, oftentimes, you would have men, for example, coming, working at very low exploitative labor prices, but then using that money to help support their families until they can piece enough together to bring families together. What's going on down there is the wages are so low that both men and women are working in those deplorable conditions for those deplorable wages. And it's very exploitative. I would akin it to a sharecropping system, because what happens is the wages are so low that they end up owing the individuals who are letting them live there, you know, for their, what you would call their very meager shelter, let me put it like that. So they can't leave. They're pretty much tied to them because they're perpetually in debt, because they're not being paid a fair wage. So then they find themselves stuck in this situation. Of course, they don't have access to any sort of health care. Of course, they don't want to let anyone know in officialdom that they're being exploited, that they're being hurt in any sort of way, that they need some assistance, because they feel as if they might be risking their opportunity to stay at all. And what's even more disheartening than that is the fact that even though we as a culture, and I think that's a very good analysis that we were given in terms of the increase in racism against immigrants in this culture. That's very true. But we have a federal government that sends mixed messages. On the one hand, I think it stands the waves of that racism and plays into it. But on the other hand, they'll also do things like immediately after Katrina, suspend the Davis-Bacon Act, which basically says that you don't have to pay people the prevailing wage, which was only $5.15 an hour in Louisiana. That was not a living wage state to begin with. You know, the bottom wages there were just the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage. And so it opened the doors and it allowed companies like Halliburton and others to be able to pay people $1 or $2 an hour if they felt like it. So individuals are still being paid at exploitative wages. And who's enforcing that? I don't really see any evidence that anyone's enforcing that.
Well, we had a tour by two people from, one was the woman, the black woman who heads up the AFT in Louisiana. New Orleans especially. What they did was that the AFT traditionally and the labor movement in New Orleans, by their work, was the one who decided who 80% of the people elected were going to be. So they've destroyed that completely by destroying the amount of schools that they opened as schools under contract.
Mm-hmm.
They opened very few, I think five, and the ones that they did open, the majority of them, are now charter schools where there's no organization, the salaries are low. With the building trades, they brought in who you're talking about, Halliburton and stuff. they had the people from the building trades working there. And then all of a sudden, they brought in these people, wanted them to train these people to take over their jobs at the lower wages. The people from the building trades said no. So what's happening was that what they've tried to do is destroy the base of the, especially the Democratic Party in New Orleans, who was among the teachers and the organized labor movement there, which is not the biggest thing in the world, but it had that kind of strength in New Orleans. What's being rebuilt, in essence, is the rich parts of the city, and that the poor parts of the city are still stacked with all the debris and everything else like that, and people are really in limbo of what they can do, you know?
That's
and
true.
It's basically a race and class thing. And it's interesting, it's like Avis said, it's like it was discussed for a while, and then all of a sudden it's like, again, in the back burner. If something dramatizes the whole issue of race and class and gender in this country, it's Katrina. Because we live that every day. I live that on my own campus, where I've seen the amount of African-American and Latino students go down dramatically every year. Because they've lifted the standards. They've not allowed special programs to come in. And even kids who are African-American and Latinos who have the SAT scores to get in are put into special programs, which have lowered. I mean, it's incredible. And you see it in terms of faculty, less and less African-American faculty. Most of the faculty is coming from other countries like Africa, which is something we have to deal with because there's a large migration nowadays from Africa that's coming into the country. And these folks are people of color like us. So, I mean, you're living it every day, yet you don't see it coming to the forefront the way it should be. You don't see people talking about doing it, and you don't see the labor movement stepping up to the plate and taking the role it should be taken in terms of defending folks like this and working with people like this to organize them, no matter how hard it is. I mean, I don't care what laws they are. The right to organize is the right of any worker or any person to make life better for themselves.
Well,
whether the law says yes or no, people in other countries die for that right, not the right to vote, the right to organize and make their living better. I mean, I think that it has to do with restoring democracy in this country, and I think that the most elemental form of democracy is restoring the right to organize, the right to be able to determine what your working and living conditions are going to be. And that right has been taken away from people, and we have to figure a way of fighting back, whether it's legal or not legal, do what we have to do to organize.
I think we're going to have to leave it there, but that's a great note to leave it with. Jose and Avis, I thank you very much for joining us and for your insightful comments, first depressing the hell out of me.
You mean you weren't depressed before? What are you
Keep doing the outstanding work you both do.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you so much. And I miss WBAI tremendously.
Yeah, we miss you in New York. We've been speaking with Avis Jones-DeWeaver, Director of Poverty Education and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and Jose Salar, Director of the Labor Education Center at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. Joining us now is cultural worker Pat Humphreys.
This is called A Cold Cup of Water, and at the time when I wrote this song, there was a campaign, this was 1996, called A Cup of Cold Water, and these organizations were all headed to Albany to address the issues of rural and migrant workers, and they were not subject to the minimum wage laws, because they're a whole category, like domestics, of workers that were left out of the labor legislation that protects all other workers. They were the bone that was thrown to the opposition so that those laws could get passed when they were, but so now state by state, including New York State, they have to address each of these things individually. So at the time, they were not subject to minimum wage laws. There were no standards for their housing. They got no days off. The growers were not even required to provide bathroom facilities where these folks worked. One of the most appalling of all was that they were not required to provide drinking water. That just stuck with me until I wrote this. Acres and acres of row upon row, scratched in the face of the land, folding the hopes of the seeds we've sown deep in the cracks of my hands. We come from places our children can't grow, some of us south of the border, seeking safety and wages and work,
dignity, food, and water. From harm may we be delivered. Demand, though we may be fired, to meet and bargain together for all workers, clean and safe shelter, and a cold cup of water. My eyes, my fingers will blister from poisonous water and air. If I speak up, the cruel boss insists there's hundreds to take my place here. From spring to the fall, we all make the rounds, from bunkhouse, orchard, and field. In 49 years, I'll be under this ground, waiting for next season's yield. From harm may we be delivered. Demand, though we may be fired, to meet and bargain together for all workers, clean and safe shelter, and a cold cup of water. Trusted the grower's promise of work, lived months away from my home. Now I yield little more than blisters and dirt, and the weariness in me's growing. If you think you owe my family no debt, let the fruit spoil all the bough. $3 billion of my toil and sweat are feeding your empire now. From harm may we be delivered. Demand, though we may be fired, to meet and bargain together for all workers, clean and safe shelter, and a cold cup of water.
Now Building Bridges speaks with Girish Srinivasan of RUPI, the research unit for political economy based in Mumbai, India.
In the very period when there have been large foreign capital flows into India, the condition of the working class has deteriorated, and the condition of the working people in general in this largely agrarian economy has also deteriorated. The reason for this is because of what is meant by development. In terms of the development that the Indian ruling classes, the way they define it, this is development, large inflows of foreign capital and a certain sort of GDP growth rates. But those actually don't reflect the productive economy of the country. So you find that in terms of calorie consumption, let's say, the calorie consumption of people has actually worsened in this period. So 75% of the people in the rural areas and almost half the people in the urban areas are not getting their minimum calorie needs. Another striking indicator is in terms of employment. In this period of liberalization and of larger capital inflows, employment in the economy has stagnated, and in the factory sector has actually fallen. So far from constituting development for the working people, this has constituted deterioration. The question is really what is meant by development. What one should think of as development is when there are more goods in the economy and there's more employment in the economy, betterment of living standards in the economy. These one would normally associate with development. But what the Indian ruling classes and the American ruling classes consider development is certain islands in the economy developing, flourishing, and these islands actually surviving parasitically off the rest of the economy. In the period of economic liberalization, distribution of income has been even more skewed, such that, in fact, there's been redistribution upward. And it's these little pockets, largely in the urban areas, which, when flourishing, give you the illusion of growth. The Indian ruling classes are desperate to get recognition as a major power. Actually, everybody in the world knows that India is not a major power in the sense that it cannot shape world politics in the way that the United States can. It doesn't have the economic strength, it doesn't have the military strength. But the United States has realized that it's very important for the Indian rulers that they get this tag. And so they are, in fact, playing up the notion of India being a major power in world politics because they want India to ally with the United States, in fact, to do its dirty work in the region. They want the Indian military to do various low-grade tasks in this South Asian region and in the Asian region overall. In fact, there are documents of the United States which put this in rather blunt terms. There's a U.S. War College study which says that basically we need Indian support because we have global interests. And we have a very large area to police. We would be spreading our forces very thin if we try to cover all of that area. And so we need countries like India to do the low-end tasks. That's what they want India for. They also want India because they have certain long-term plans to target China, which they see as an emerging power. And they think that India is an appropriate counterpoise to China in this region. So for that, too, they want Indian support. The parliamentary political parties, unfortunately, are almost unanimous in supporting the measures of globalization, which have really worsened the conditions of the mass of people. And many of the major trade unions are affiliated to those political parties and therefore are unable to put up any serious resistance. And that is the reason why there has not yet been sort of fight back which is required. But slowly that fight back is emerging, spontaneous in some places, in a more organized way in some places, at the grassroots. And it takes a certain length of time for that sort of fight back to gather a certain momentum. What we're seeing, say, now in Latin America, where almost throughout the region there is a fight back against these policies of neoliberalism, we can see the signs of that taking place in India in different pockets. For example, last year there was a major struggle of the workers of the Honda plant just outside the Indian capital, Delhi. And these workers were beaten very badly by the police. In fact, hundreds of them were hospitalized, and hundreds more were arrested. Many of them who were arrested were, in fact, in badly injured condition. In the organized sector of industry, which, after all, only constitutes a very small fraction of the total Indian workforce, even in the organized sector of industry, workers are having to put up such struggle. It was significant, and it evoked a widespread response in the working class. Again, another important struggle is regarding the peasants' struggle against the acquisition of their land forcibly at depressed rates by the state on behalf of the industrialists. A major struggle took place recently, and is continuing, in fact, in the eastern state of Orissa, in a region called Kalinga Nagar, where for some large Indian companies, government was forcibly acquiring land at the point of a gun, and the peasants fought back. A large number of them were killed in firing. Many more were brutally mutilated. However, that struggle continued in the face of that terrible repression and evoked a very widespread response, such that there was a general strike in three states, including that state of Orissa, to protest this repression. So these struggles are getting wider solidarity. Another significant struggle that has taken place recently of the electricity workers of the northwestern state of Punjab, who are fighting against privatization. Now, what was significant there was that they linked up with the peasants of that state and staged very massive rallies against the privatization. This link between the workers and the peasants in fighting the government policies is crucial. And if the working class of the country doesn't build such solidarity, it won't have the sort of fighting power and the vision of the alternative which is required for any sustained fight. Unfortunately, the organized labor movement, so-called, there is the organized labor inertia, because, as I said, they are really linked to parties which have these very globalization policies. It's the movements that are taking place at the ground level, sometimes spontaneous, sometimes organized. And it takes time for these struggles to link with each other, but that linkage is coming. And as they link with each other, they will be able to put up a much more sustained and much more militant resistance. And this is, therefore, these are struggles outside the parliamentary sphere, you can say. The government, of course, has strengthened the arms of the military and the police to deal with these types of struggles. You find, therefore, that large parts of the country are treated as zones in which the paramilitary forces can commit any type of atrocity, and where the government is even strengthening itself with helicopters and unmanned aerial vehicles imported from Israel in order to hunt out those forces which are fighting in a militant way for these sorts of long-term demands. Just as in China, the government set up certain things like the special economic zones, where no labor law would operate. The same things are being done by the Indian government, and it is, citing China as an example, large tracts of land are being handed over to industrialists who will then in those zones, in those special economic zones which are meant for export, no labor law will operate. In fact, the labor law machinery, including the labor commissioner, will not exist there, and only an administrative officer will handle all labor issues. Those administering those economic zones, that is, say, the industrialists, will have their own security forces. Law and order will be conducted by those security forces. This is the sort of thing which is taking place on the Chinese model. Again, the linkage is also to be seen in the fact that while Indian workers now are fighting directly various multinationals which are also operating in the United States and in other countries. Small-scale retail accounts for some 35 million people's employment in India. These people are being threatened by various large firms like Walmart, which we're familiar with in the United States. So these forces of international capital are also operating in a more direct way in India now, and the consequences, therefore, are similar. One thing that American workers need to know, in America there's a lot of publicity about how jobs are being outsourced to India and how American workers' employment is being destroyed by the Indian workers, it would seem. For one, jobs that are outsourced to India, let's say in the software and in the IT-enabled sectors, the PPOs, these constitute 0.25% of the total Indian workforce. So there's no great boom in employment in India as a result of the jobs that are outsourced in the United States. While surely those do, that outsourcing does act as a method of depressing the wages of American workers, Indian workers are not benefiting. The global corporations are benefiting, and they're depressing both the American workers' wages and the Indian workers. The jobs that Indian middle class gain in the IT-enabled sector and the IT sector are more than made up for by the jobs that are lost to Indian workers with pre-import goods from the developed country. There is such a free flow of goods from the developed countries into India, and all import restrictions are removed. Indian workers lose their jobs to those imports. Those job losses are much larger, in fact, than the job gains from the IT-enabled sector and IT sector. So actually, the interests of the Indian workers and the American workers are common, and both these interests are pitted against the global corporations which are making a killing off this worldwide wage depression. I think only one more point that's worth mentioning is that while the struggle takes place of workers around the world, and the workers around the world need to link up against the forces which are really attacking workers around the world, of course the struggles will also be very much local and will be for political power in their own countries. And the working people in India will be fighting their own ruling classes as well, because they need to exercise their own political power in their own country. In order to be able to do that, of course, they also have to link with all the forces which are similarly fighting imperialism around the world.
That's a great point to end on. It's perfect for Labor Day. Workers of the world, unite.
You have nothing to lose but your change. You have a world to win.
Girish, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Girish Srinivasan of RUPI, the Research Unit for Political Economy, based in Mumbai, India.
Continuing on a journey around the globe, now with us Patrick Craven, spokesperson for the Congress of South African Trade Unions.
Jobs and poverty and the inequality are definitely issues. South Africa has recently, according to one survey, been declared the most unequal society in the entire world, gap between the richest and the poorest. This is having the inevitable effect at this very moment. There are several groups of very low-paid workers who are on strike precisely to try to start to bridge this huge income divide between the poorest and the richest in this country. The big problem we have is that many of the business people, chief executives and company presidents, think their salaries should be measured by first world standards. They expect to get the same sort of salary as their opposite numbers in New York or Chicago. But they expect their workers who live at African standards. So consequently, in the midst of what is promoted as an economic boom, more than 20 million South Africans are estimated to be living below the official United Nations definition of poverty. And that is really an impossible situation, particularly for a trade union, to tolerate. We have always drawn a clear distinction between political progress and economic progress. Politically, South Africa has been transformed. It's easy to forget that 12 years ago, the majority of people didn't even have the vote. They were treated as little better than slaves. told where they could live, where they could work. It was one of the most deplorable political regimes in the world. We now have one of the most democratic regimes in the world, with a constitution which guarantees human rights, a battery of laws which, at least on paper, guarantee all sorts of minimum standards for workers and for people generally. On the economic front, however, the situation is very, very different. There's actually very little change. The ownership patterns in terms of class, race and gender have hardly changed at all. In fact, one report this week suggested that it's even going backwards, that there are actually now more white males in top positions in industry than there were a few years ago, which is an incredible statistic given that we're supposed to have had a policy of black economic empowerment, which has clearly completely failed. And as trade unions, we're particularly concerned that even the small number of black people who have benefited from black economic empowerment, some of whom are now very rich, are a tiny proportion of the population. And the vast majority of what are sometimes called the previously disadvantaged population groups are really no better off in economic terms than they were previously. And that's the main challenge we have to face, to try to achieve the sort of advances we've achieved on the political front, on the economic front. We haven't at this stage started discussing candidates, or indeed of pulling out of the alliance with the ANC. But what we are arguing very strongly is that the alliance needs to function much more effectively. The idea of the alliance would be that it would be a major policy formulating organization that would roll out the main policies and strategies of government. And this is clearly not happening. And indeed, we've made the point that even the ANC itself is being sidelined. And increasingly important policy decisions have been taken purely at the level of government, which is subject to a lot of lobbying from business interests as well, both domestic and international, with organizations like the World Bank being able to put pressure on government. And this way it bypasses the democratic structures of the alliance. But it'd be wrong to see this as a debate between COSATU and the ANC or between the Communist Party and the ANC, because within the ranks of the ANC, there's a huge debate going on about its future role. And this will come to the fore at its conference next year in December. So at this stage, I think it would be quite wrong for COSATU to simply pull out of that alliance, particularly because you have a huge overlap of membership, which I think sometimes international observers aren't aware of. But when you talk about splits between COSATU, the ANC, and the Communist Party, you're talking about an organization in which a lot of people are members of all three, certainly at least two of them. And when it comes down to the local level, you're talking about exactly the same people. So it would be impossible, really, to split. They remain organically united at the grassroots. And what we need is not organizational changes so much as political changes in the kind of policies which the government adopts and the way in which they are formulated and implemented through the alliance. No, I think South Africa is in a better position in some ways than your country, or for that matter Australia, where there are some savage attacks being launched on trade union rights, which could destroy the whole basis of trade unionism. Certainly in terms of the law, South Africa has one of the most progressive legal structures for trade unions, and there's been no serious suggestion from anybody, even from business, that the right to organize should be abolished. But there is, particularly from business, and it's sometimes taken up by commentators, talk about inflexible labor laws. They're not talking so much about the right to organize, more the laws that protect workers from unfair dismissal, saying that it's too difficult to get rid of workers, which we totally reject. We think, given the high levels of unemployment and the number of people who are in fact being retrenched or dismissed, it clearly is not an obstacle. And in any case, it's never been proved to us that there is a connection between the right of employers to hire and fire workers and the health of the economy and the number of jobs being created. We believe that this is a smokescreen that possibly hides the kind of measures which you were talking about in your country, which some people would like to introduce here, but wouldn't dare at this stage put it forward openly. I think the main reason for that, it's too recently in our history. The trade unions were subject to all sorts of restrictions that were barely tolerated under the old regime. And it was a major, major victory to get those trade unions created. And nobody in the sort of serious mainstream of politics would actually argue that trade unions should be restricted in any way. The other big problem, of course, is that while all this may be true in theory, there are still many sectors of the economy, particularly on the farms, in agriculture, where the trade unions are not really an effective force. It's very, very difficult to organize in these farms. And one of the biggest challenges we face as a federation to get some of these workers better organized. Another problem we have, even in the more urban areas, is the growth of casualization. I don't know if this is the problem to the same extent in America, but there's a tendency for jobs which were previously permanent to be outsourced to possibly labor brokers, so that individual workers work for short periods on short-term contracts and don't have the same job security, usually lower wages as well. And this, again, is another huge challenge because, of course, it's also more difficult to keep such workers organized in trade unions. And so that's one of the battles which we're having to take on. It isn't so much a threat to trade unions themselves, but certainly is to a very important part of their constituents. Zimbabwe is also facing now an economic catastrophe, which is having a big impact in South Africa and indeed other countries like Botswana, where there are now floods. Nobody really knows how many, but it's certainly running into millions of people fleeing Zimbabwe in search of work. And a growing proportion of the South African workforce, in fact, are from Zimbabwe. Only this week, the Department of Labor in South Africa actually decided that they had to open up an office on the border so as to try and regulate the flow of Zimbabwean immigrants, which we broadly welcome because the biggest problem which we have faced as a trade union, and this will be familiar, I think, to American trade unionists near the border with Mexico, that many Zimbabwean workers were being ruthlessly exploited because of their illegal status. They couldn't really complain, which was obviously extremely bad for them, but it also meant that South African workers were finding it more difficult to get employment. And we hope that this office will be one step towards making sure that Zimbabwean workers get exactly the same rights to minimum wage levels, protection against unfair dismissal, and all the other provisions which are supposed in law to apply not just to South African citizens, but anybody working in South Africa.
Patrick Craven, I wish we had longer to speak with you, but I want to thank you certainly for the glimpse of some of the issues that are unfolding in the economy and issues before the organized movement of KUSATU.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
And we've been speaking with Patrick Craven, spokesperson for the Congress of South African Trade Unions.
You've been listening to A Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special reflecting on Labor Day, produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.